This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. We're here ready to discuss the important events of this past week. In the studio here in Edmond, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Good to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Thanks for having me.
And from our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
Each week, the staff of the Trumpet Magazine produces a digest of the important news of the week. It's called the Trumpet Weekly. It's a free 12-page report. You can go to thetrumpet.com and get a subscription. Receive that in your email inbox every Friday afternoon. The cover story this week is an article that Brent wrote called "Why Does the Pope Keep Meeting with Mahmoud Abbas?" The Vatican confirmed this week that Pope Francis will meet with Palestinian Authority President Abbas in Rome tomorrow, one day before the Paris Peace Conference, which is expected to work against Israel's interests. So the Vatican certainly seems to be showing which side of the Arab-Jew conflict it feels most closely aligned with. To tell us more about this, we're going to turn to the author of that article, our man in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
It's interesting to go back and see over the past few years just how often these two individuals have met. I haven't done a running tally with all other world leaders and how many times they've met with the Pope, but this is the fifth personal meeting between Mahmoud Abbas and the Pope Francis since 2013. So this is quite a few. Three of those have been at the Vatican. I think four of those have been at the Vatican, and one of them has been inside Israel. You remember back to 2014 when the Pope did visit Israel and the Palestinian territories, if we can call them that. And that visit itself was in response to him being invited there by Mahmoud Abbas. So we have to ask ourselves why so many meetings between these two leaders. For a religious leader to be having so many meetings with a very controversial figure. Don't forget, Mahmoud Abbas, he leads the PLO, who was formerly led by Yasser Arafat, terrorist, really, backed, a terrorist organization that does have blood on its hands. Nowadays, it's more moderate, you could say, and it is the voice of the Palestinian people. But even so, for the Pope to meet so often with the Palestinian leader and really not as much with the Israelis and not show as much solidarity with the Israeli cause as the Palestinian people is very strange for a religious figure to do that, it seems. Now, if we do go back just a couple of to show how pro-Palestinian this Pope is, you remember the most memorable shot of that visit to Israel was when the Pope decided off the cuff, apparently, according to his office, to stop by the security barrier right next to a big, you know, quote, "Free Palestine" written on the security barrier in the West Bank near Ramallah, and for the Pope to go beside that wall and start praying beside that wall in a what would normally be seen in a kind of a repose that we normally seen against the Western Wailing Wall, something done in the Jewish site. And, you know, that was just one thing. Then he met with the Palestinian Christian leader there, somebody that really in his message talked about modern day Herods killing Christ like children. And the Pope didn't condemn that. He was obviously referring to the Israelis and how they're treating the Palestinians. Then there was a year later when Mahmoud Abbas was in Rome, in the Vatican. He called him an angel of peace. That's what the Pope called Mahmoud Abbas.
I don't imagine now, that Mahmoud Abbas gets called that by too many people.
No, not at all. But he's called it by the Pope, who the Pope apparently represents 1.1 plus billion people on the earth, billion Catholics. And here is the leader of that church that isn't really talking about how much Israel has the right to defend itself and so on and so forth, but says the Palestinians deserve a state. I'm going to meet with the Palestinian leader right before a conference takes place in Paris to show everybody who I support in this ongoing peace process. Now, this meeting on Saturday. We didn't really know what it was for initially, but it turns out that they're going to inaugurate inside the Vatican, well, inside Rome, the Palestinian embassy there, right there inside Rome the day before this peace conference. That's why Mahmoud Abbas is there. And we've just been tracking this for a number of years, this close relationship between the Vatican and the Palestinians, because it has so many prophetic implications to it.
Right. It is really important to view all of this in context with the Vatican's interest in Jerusalem from a historical perspective, because it's really easy to look at this in terms of the Pope trying to help ameliorate the problems between the Arabs and the Jews. And, you know, he's talking about peace. He's using the right terminology. But the Vatican has very direct and very emotional interest in the city that's kind of at the center of this entire controversy.
Right. You know, we normally talk about Jerusalem being the third holiest site of Islam, the holiest site of Judaism, but people tend to forget sometimes that it's also the holiest site in Christianity as well. And there has been so much blood, Jewish blood, Muslim blood, that has been spilt by the Catholic Church through history to try and take Jerusalem. And it's interesting, I posted this article just on Facebook yesterday, and a number of comments from Israelis, that all, not all of them, but like 90% of them are, this is not surprising. The Catholic Church has never liked us. They're always in it for themselves. Mm-hmm. These two leaders flocked, like birds of a feather flocked together, a couple of people were saying, just because they realize that the Catholic Church has other motives in supporting the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, it's, I just thought of this just now, too. There almost seems to be a real big double standard on some of the Pope's support for a separate Palestinian state, too, because it seems like whenever he's in Europe or whenever he's in the United States, he's always talking about we need to welcome other immigrants and other cultures and other things into us and, you know, mix into one people, and you shouldn't have borders with Mexico. You should welcome Hispanics into the country. You should welcome Arab refugees into Europe. And yet when he's in Israel, he seems like, well, it's not fair that Jews and Palestinians should live together. The Palestinians need their own homeland state. It's really almost the only country I can think of where he takes that opinion.
Well, you really, in this article that you have on the cover of this week's Trumpet Weekly, kind of go back and document this history between these two, and particularly the current Pope and the Palestinian leader, put it in its historical context, especially with respect to the Vatican's designs on Jerusalem, bring in some of those prophecies. There's a lot of great information here. You can find it in the Trumpet Weekly in a shortened version, but you can find the full article online at thetrumpet.com. So that's definitely something that I would encourage our listeners to go take a look at. Thanks for that, Brent. America is known as the most powerful military in the world. Many believe it is as close to invincible as you can get. But as we brought out in several cases this past year, or really the last couple of years, there are a lot of reasons why this isn't exactly the full picture of America's military. An article out this week that we paraphrase in this week's Trumpet Weekly talks about this subject. And for this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, this article is called The Myth of American Invincibility. And what I think it does really well is summarize really three key things that not in just this author's opinion are potentially catastrophic weaknesses in America's opinion, but are three things that a whole range of military experts are talking about. In some ways, I was disappointed to see the article because I've been thinking about writing something very similar myself. And these are these are about the same kind of three core things even that I would identify just based on all the talk that's out there. So it's something that's backed up by much more than just this one article. But he makes the comparison to France in World War II. And if you look at France in World War II, they looked incredibly powerful. They had, as he puts in this article, a reputation for military invincibility. However, they did not understand, really, the modern weapons, and they were prepared for an outdated form of warfare. They invested heavily in this line of forts, for example, the Maginot Line, that never really ended up getting much use because Hitler just drove right round them. So, and it's a military that was very powerful on paper that collapsed in just 6 weeks. And this article compares that to the American military. It makes three key comparisons. It firstly points out America relies very heavily on supercarriers. America spends billions on aircraft carriers. Its entire navy is structured around aircraft carrier strike groups. And he writes, on paper, America's dominance looks total because, you know, America has 10 aircraft carriers and Russia and China can barely field one each. But, he says, you look at that a bit more closely, he points out that U.S. aircraft carriers keep getting sunk in military engagements. And this is kind of a hot topic of debate and discussion right now. But there is a growing body of opinion that says aircraft carriers are obsolete and would probably be wiped out very quickly in the event of a war. Now, I guess it's impossible to know absolutely for certain without fighting a war. But here's an example of an area where America has just invested hundreds of billions, really put a lot of stock into, that conditions have changed dramatically. There was no such thing as satellites and missiles when the last time aircraft carriers were really tested, which was in World War II. An aircraft carrier just needed to sail over the horizon and then it had disappeared. You couldn't find it. That's not the case today. They can be reached and destroyed in the middle of the ocean. A lot of things have changed. So that's one key area that America's invested a lot. The other one that he brings out is stealth technology, where this is quite simple. America's invested a lot in stealth. However, Russia and China can get around that. They can detect, they have the technology to be able to detect American stealth aircraft. They're greatly helped by the fact that the F-35, for example, America's brand new stealth weapon, has the hottest engine of just about any plane out there. And so, fine, it may be hard to find on radar, but it's very easy to find on infrared. So this is a technology where America's invested a lot that actually is not as powerful as a lot of people think it is. And then the final thing he points to is networks and satellites, which is something even Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry has pointed to consistently as being a key weakness of America. They depend a lot on information technology. They depend a lot on satellites as well. And these are things that can be taken down relatively easily. So America's military has not been tested really for 70 years. You've got this huge edifice, but because it's not been tested, there's a lot of people saying, well, how do we know that it's actually as strong as it looks on paper? And all of history tells us, well, we can't really be sure of that.
Right. Stephen Flurry talked about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio show this morning, and just drawing attention to those prophecies that just show how, despite preponderant military power and spending a whole lot of money and resources on this kind of military strength, that it doesn't amount to anything. You don't see that the results, when you look at the overall picture in terms of America's impact on events prophetically, you see this massive void of America's presence. And so we're kind of pulling back and trying to assess, well, how is it possible that such a overwhelmingly powerful nation that spends so much on these exact tools that you're talking about here wouldn't be a factor? This kind of helps you to put the pieces together to see how that would be the case.
Right, and I think that's what really makes this article so compelling, really from our point of view, is, like Mr. Flurry brought out on that program, these trends that he brings out all tie into very specific prophecies. You know, the Bible says, your strength shall be spent in vain. And one way of doing that is building up this huge amount of strength in areas that are ultimately vain, that they don't work. And then the reason why Mr. Flurry is focused on, for example, cyber warfare and the vulnerability of America's networks, like this article brings out, is because there are specific prophecies that talk about, for example, the trumpet shall be blown, but nobody goes to battle. They paint pictures that look very like a picture of an American military compromised because its reliance on technology has been taken advantage of and hacked. So it's kind of some top military thinking, but it ties in very directly to some prophecies that we're watching as well.
I've seen a number of even like Chinese defense reports highlighting some of the same key vulnerabilities that are highlighted in this in this week article, especially about like ship supply lines and satellite vulnerabilities in light of a potential conflict between U.S. and China in the South China Sea. And of course, none of these Chinese generals at this point are actually realistically thinking they could actually invade the American homeland. But they are saying some of these vulnerabilities are something that you could exploit to win a localized battle in a very strategic sea gate in the South China Sea, which is also prophetic in itself. And that I think, as we pointed out last summer in our trumpet cover about the South China Sea, is prophetically any future war against America begins with a trade siege, which would mean that America would at some point lose the ability to defend the vital sea routes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. And one other point that I thought this article made that was just quickly very good, it talks about how America's military invincibility may be just waiting to be toppled by anyone clever and gutsy enough to give the right shove. And if you look at history, you see that all the time. I mean, that's Napoleon, that's Alexander the Great, that's so many of these names that we remember from history were people who took on powers that at modern times people thought were invincible. They saw through that and they were audacious enough to try and give it a shove. We like to think, okay, well, nobody's even going to try and overturn this. But it's something that has happened repeatedly throughout history.
Right. All of the best military minds in all of these other militaries have to be looking at the disparity between American spending and American capability and their own, and finding, you know, searching for any vulnerability, any way that they would be able to level the playing field. And in exactly the ways that this individual writing for this week is describing. So all of these vulnerabilities are bound to be exposed at some point. Well, you're listening to Trumpet Hour. This is our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. Another area America is proving itself vulnerable in is that of cybersecurity. After the alleged Russian hack of the Democratic National Convention, the U.S. is now grappling with the possibility that it's falling behind in cyber warfare. For this, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Well, this is obviously something that's been going on for a decade or two decades, but it's definitely in the news a lot right now because of that Russian hack on the Democratic National Convention. Seems like you hear that absolutely every time you turn on the news these days. And Donald Trump, President-elect Donald Trump's really come out and criticized the DNC for having really bad cybersecurity, for allowing something like that to happen. And of course, the Democratic Party is a private party. It's not necessarily a government, an official government agency, but they have, this has just really drawn a light that we have had that happen a lot recently too. They had on the Senate floor this week, they had our National Security Agency Director, Admiral Michael Rogers, was talking about just this threat of foreign enemies, especially Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and the Islamic State. I guess they call those the 4+1, is like the major players on like cyber threats against America. And so we'll see with in addition to the Russian hack on the DNC, you had a North Korean hack against one of the main Hollywood movie theaters a couple years back, and also this China's been hacking into like power grid and even the military, looking for secrets for a number of decades now. And it really ties back into the kind of some of the first story that Richard was talking about kind of this asymmetrical warfare. Is the National Security Advisor pointed out that he said America actually spends twice as much on cybersecurity as Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, and the Islamic State combined. And yet, you still get Chinese hackers that are able to break into the Pentagon every few months. And it could just because this is something that it's not even so much about the money and the materials as it is just about someone just like who's really intellectually clever and looks for loopholes.
Yeah, the point about asymmetrical warfare is a really good one. I mean, that's kind of like the buzzword of so much of what we talk about with America's military, where America depends on a whole load of things. It's easier to disrupt than it is to protect. And protecting a computer system is like that. There are probably hundreds or thousands or more potential vulnerabilities that the American kind of cyber defense units have to stop, whereas China or Japan or Russia only needs to find one. And it's like that with America's satellites. It's like that with so many things, where it's vastly easier for one, for a country to find a way in than it is for America to keep everybody out. And that just kind of adds to the challenges facing America and this and a whole range of other areas.
Right. And that is, and we have pointed out here before that technology, in some ways, it's America's greatest strengthness, but it's also like its Achilles heel, because there are other nations. Russia's one of them that spends a lot more time training their soldiers on low-tech warfare as well. I think probably one of the probably most kind of neat or famous examples is this, like in Russian spy services, where Putin had brought back like typewriters and taught them how to use the old like Cold War typewriters and manila envelopes. Mm-hmm. Not as high tech as the encryption, but if your encryption's broke, it's harder to, you can't hack a typewriter. So it's, and that's something that America has not spent a ton of time looking at. What would you do in a situation where your satellites were out and you're fighting blind?
Right, exactly. The kinds of problems that we were discussing in the last segment, and just how vulnerable America is because of its dependence on these very expensive, very high-tech technologies, and that makes us more vulnerable than anyone to cyber attacks. Well, thanks for that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. One more story here. Russia may well have tried to influence the outcome of America's presidential election. The U.S. President-elect Donald Trump has promised to improve America's cooperation with Russia, but he has also promised to stand up against China. And this puts Russian President Vladimir Putin in an interesting position. Does he align with America or with China? For this story, we're going to go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, the world's most powerful nation is just days away from that major leadership transition with Mr. Trump just about to assume power. And it does put Russia's foreign policy at a strategic crossroads. That's actually the title of an article that we've published this week. It's by the Eurasia Review, and it's called Russia's Foreign Policy at a Strategic Crossroads in 2017. And the gist of this article is basically that Mr. Trump has... he's made two sets of promises, like you mentioned there. On one side have been his promises to really stand up to China, to challenge China's aggression, and to even push back at China on some fronts. And then on the other side have been Mr. Trump's promises to vastly improve America's relationship with Russia. So from the perspective of Russia and President Vladimir Putin there, there's a big decision to be made. Putin will have to choose between either repairing Moscow's ties with Washington or continuing Moscow's partnership with Beijing. It doesn't look like there's any way that Russia would be able to do both, at least for more than a very short-term sort of a strategy. This Eurasia Review piece says, I'll just read a short quote from it here. It says, "Would Russia opt for restoring its relationship with the U.S. as one of established global heavyweights, or would Russia persist in siding with a revisionist power like China, bent on overturning the established stability status quo? It's a complex question, which some are likely to dismiss as speculative, but that is the reality which Russia's foreign policy directions have to cope with in 2017. So if you read this Eurasia Review piece, it seems pretty optimistic that Russia might opt for a thaw with the U.S. and for loosening or even full detachment from its China linkage. But I don't think that there's actually much grounds for that kind of optimism. It is true that there's mutual respect between Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump, but it doesn't seem to be nearly enough to undo all of the tensions between Russia and America. The Eurasia Review, that quote that I just mentioned there, it says that China is bent on overturning the established stability status quo. But the thing is, Russia has that exact same goal. Russia opposes the U.S. at every available opportunity. And while there could be some détente under President Trump, that wouldn't change this sort of foundational goal of Russia's. And then also at the trumpet, of course, we look at these kinds of situations through the lens of Bible prophecy. And one of the big prophecies that we're watching for is Russia and China forming a military bloc that opposes Western powers. There are all kinds of scriptures that explain that that will happen in the years ahead. So it does look like Russia is at a bit of a foreign policy crossroads, but I think that we don't have to really lose much sleep wondering which path it'll take. If Trump takes a hard line toward China, and if that forces Russia to choose between the two, then I believe we can be pretty confident that Russia will continue to lean toward China.
Yeah, actually, the Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, delivered a Key of David program this week where he was just talking about how dangerous America's efforts to align itself with Russia really will prove to be if it does go that direction, that it's going to really come back to bite the United States. We're playing a dangerous game there, and as you made clear, as prophecy makes clear, the alignment of nations is very clear and direct. It's very easy to track. You can see a whole lot of reasons why this would be a fool's gold to try to pursue that type of a relationship. But definitely an area where Bible prophecy gives us informs us of the correct view in a way that people might not be able to see at first glance. Well, thank you for that, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about how last week's terrorist attack in Israel has generated sympathy among Europeans, how several nations are calling on Germany to increase its power and leadership, how more Asian allies are turning against America, and a nation that's considering giving everyone a guaranteed basic income, whether or not they work for it. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in the first segment about how the Vatican is twisting the knife against Israel. But you're seeing something very different from Europe's political leaders this past week, as we talked about on our Wednesday program. Last Sunday in Jerusalem, a Palestinian got behind the wheel of a large truck and drove it through a group of unsuspecting Israeli soldiers. The attack killed 4 and wounded 17 others, and it paralleled similar attacks that have taken place in Europe. And it appears that it generated sympathy among some Europeans. For this story, we're going to go back to Jerusalem and Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, so it's really quite interesting to look at Europe's response to the latest attack on Sunday, as opposed to or in comparison to earlier similar attacks in Israel. Car rammings, bulldozer rammings, that type of thing that have happened in Israel a lot for the past 3 years, really. And one author, Kanaan Lipschitz, writing for the Times of Israel this week, really did compare the European response back then to how they are responding now after they've experienced some of their own unprovoked such attacks, car rammings, truck rammings, that type of thing. He started it this way. When a Palestinian terrorist used a car to ram and kill an Israeli soldier in eastern Jerusalem in 2014, the European Union urged restraint and, without condemning the attack, called it merely, quote, further painful evidence of the need to undertake serious efforts towards a sustainable peace. Now, that statement was by Federica Mogherini, the current EU foreign relations chief. And according to the former ambassador, Oded Iran, just this past week, he said that was like the typical reaction from an EU politician saying that they don't condemn while they don't really condemn the attack, they say there's a reason for it. There's rationale behind these such attacks that are made by Palestinians on Israelis. Now, 2 years later, these European officials have a much different reaction. This is the statement that Brussels released just this past week. They said, "The European Union condemns the murder of these 4 young Israelis, as well as any praise or incitement for terrorist acts." So the act itself was pretty much the same as 2014, yet the response from the European Union was totally different.
So for Europe to express this kind of compassion or this kind of sympathy for what happened in Israel, this has to be really creating some enthusiasm among Israelis, especially in light of what we've been talking about, just how isolated they're becoming as America, as the Obama administration makes these anti-Israel moves, and the Security Council passes this resolution that's very anti-Israel. This has to be very encouraging to the Israelis.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think Israelis are rejoicing at these terrorist attacks that took place in Europe earlier this year and even into previously last year. They're not rejoicing about death of Europeans. But at the same time, there is a sense that, you know, now Europeans know how we feel. They didn't provoke these attacks. They didn't do anything to make these Islamists attack them. They just did it. And Europeans were the victims. And now the Israelis feel like the Europeans finally feel that. Now, the Europeans can finally relate to the Israelis in that way. And it was really interesting just to look at even some of the more public gestures that took place in the past week in response to the attack. The most stunning of these was the Brandenburg Gate there in Berlin, lighting up with the Israeli flag, blue and white, with a star of David right in the middle of it. This is an iconic image that back during World War II, it had the Nazi flag all over it. Mm-hmm. And now what we have is the Israeli Jewish flag right there in the middle of Berlin. And Germany also released a statement. The German Foreign Ministry shared that picture on Twitter, stating that it was in solidarity with Israel. Solidarity. They knew exactly how Israelis felt, and they were going to stand with Israel in the face of these terrorist attacks. Something that you didn't see in the previous car rammings, in the previous truck attacks in years gone by.
But in a sense, it seems like it would be as much a thumbing of the nose in the Arabs' face and the Muslims that are provoking these attacks and causing these attacks as it was solidarity with Israel.
Sure thing. Yeah, exactly. You could read into it that way for sure. And as you said, I mean, the Israelis have felt more isolated continuously and by Europe, by the United States. And now they're hoping that at least in Europe, there is a sense that they're coming around to their senses to understand the Israelis' viewpoint.
Now, it's a really interesting thing to watch develop, particularly in light of the prophecies that we understand that we've been talking about for quite some time, that there is going to be a surface level alignment or at least a warming of the relationship between Germany and Israel. And we've been watching this develop to some degree. It's particularly interesting to see it happening or accelerating, warming even more in light of Islamist terrorist attacks.
Yeah. I mean, we've been tracking it, especially through the chancellorship of Angela Merkel. She is probably Israel's one of Israel's greatest friends in Europe, and she's expressed such on trips to Israel. And yet, what is going to make Germany feel closer to Israel? It's them feeling the same type of attacks. I think if you look at Bible prophecy, you know, and Bible prophecy kind of indicates that Israel does go to Germany and asks for their help. Mm-hmm. And why would they go to Germany and ask for their help unless they thought that they were on their side? Mm-hmm. And it looks like right now there is a sincere effort by Germany to show Israel that they're on their side. So these prophecies are starting to align quite nicely when you realize just how much Israel sees Germany as a friend through these attacks.
Yeah, it's exactly these kinds of gestures that lay the foundation for a future effort by Israel to seek help from Germany. And it seems like the pressure on them or the incentive for them to undertake that kind of a gesture toward Germany only increases in light of everything else that's happening. It'll be interesting to see what happens once the Trump administration comes into power and the relationship between the United States and Israel is modified based on the new administration. But you definitely see that groundwork being laid for a relationship between Germany and Israel in a way that it has not been before.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, going into this next year, we don't even the Germans have said as much. They expect these type of attacks to continue. It would be an absolute miracle for there not to be another attack. And every time it happens, they will understand more of the Israeli position, which will warm their heart to the Jews.
Thanks for that, Brent. We've been talking about how much a Donald Trump presidency is causing other nations to recalculate their own foreign policies. For Europe, this is increasing the motivation to unify, to step up militarily. This week, more voices chimed in with this argument and specifically said that the responsibility really falls to Germany. For this story, we're going to go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
Yes, we saw quite a few articles this week from a few different sources. Once again, calling for Germany to lead, calling for Germany to do more. It almost seems, you know, if this had happened, say, a year ago, I could well see this being the top item for the show, the main thing that we talk about. But it's become so common now, it almost seems like we have an article on this every week in the Trumpet Weekly. We're down in the second half of the Trumpet Weekly because this is just something that has become routine. We see it all the time, that people want Germany to step up. Now, the specific news from this week, one came from the center-right candidate in France's upcoming presidential election, François Fillon. And he said that Donald Trump election, along with the Berlin attack, he said that those are a game changer. And he said that Germany can no longer play the role of a pacifist. And he really launched a call for kind of this Franco-German heart of Europe, a unity within Europe, and for France and Germany to kind of push together for a stronger European military. And in the same week, you had pretty much the same call from the former German foreign minister and former vice chancellor, Joschka Fischer. And he made a very similar call in an article for Project Syndicate. It was also published in the German press, where he again said the same thing about Donald Trump and the difficult that position that puts Europe in regarding Russia. And he concludes his article writing that the old EU developed into an economic power because it was protected beneath the US security umbrella. But without this guarantee, it can address its current geopolitical realities only by developing its own capacity to project political and military power. And again, calling on France and Germany to together push this forward within Europe. He calls those two nations Europe's indispensable nations. And then the final article we kind of have in this section, the Trumpet Weekly, comes from on the National Review with the rather boring title, Calls to Arms Part 1. But I think it does a fantastic job of just showing how much Germany has changed already in this regard, how much their spending has changed, how much their military deployments have changed, but far more importantly, how much the attitude of just Germans have changed to military deployments. It talks about how in the 1980s, when there was talk of this kind of thing, there were massive protests and huge opposition, while now there's no real opposition at all. Nobody really disagrees that Germany needs to spend more and do more. So just more evidence of these shifts within Germany.
What you just said is really quite extraordinary, because we have talked about, well, we were even just talking about in the last couple of weeks, that information that came out from Margaret Thatcher's the period during the time that the Berlin Wall fell, when she was voicing very strong opposition to even the unification of Germany. And even in recent years, say down in Greece, when they were having to deal with some of the impositions that Germany was placing on their economy, there were, you know, pictures of Merkel with Hitler mustaches and that type of thing. And there has been some level of pushback against what is perceived to be Germany's rise in power. Has that really fallen away since that time? Is it just a matter of the fact that they know that the threats are such that there's no other option but to empower Germany?
Well, I think it depends where you are. I don't think it's fallen away in Greece, because Greece doesn't feel particularly threatened by Russia. They're not really desperate for German protection. Instead, their main threat is probably the German economic threat. So I think there's still a lot of anger there. But this article certainly quotes from a lot of leaders. It's certainly changed since Margaret Thatcher's time. It quotes that famous quote from the then Polish minister, Radek Sikorski, who said, "I fear German power less than I'm beginning to fear German inactivity." Mm-hmm. And he also said, you have become Europe's indispensable nation. I think this whole attitude and this shift, especially within Eastern Europe, but as we saw, it comes from France and Western Europe as well, was really articulated well by the Lithuanian president. And there's a quote from her in this article. And she said, I think we're at a historic turning point. First, a lot of time has passed and a breakthrough is occurring in the German mindset. Time for self-doubt, fear, reluctance to take responsibility, and dread of what Putin might think is over. So minds within Europe are changing and have changed already. I think they've changed faster than German minds have regarding German power. And minds within Germany are changing. And whether it's because people like France want more German help against terrorism in North Africa and the Middle East, or whether it's like Poland and Lithuania that want more German help against Russia, there are very, very few that are scared of German power and a lot that want Germany to do much more.
And it seems like maybe you can just give us a quick sense of how much of a change this represents just in terms of France's attitude toward Germany. To hear Francis Fillon saying these things, I mean, I'm thinking just really a few years ago when it was really viewed, France was viewed more as a counterweight, or they were seen as kind of, equal powers working together to create this unified European project. It seems like France has now sort of graciously acquiesced and said, yes, Germany really is closer to the top, and they don't feel quite so compelled to serve as a counterweight to that.
I don't think it's quite that gracious, actually. I think we probably will see some friction here. I think, firstly, you're right, there has been that change in terms of the power of Europe, and I think that happened in the 2008 financial crisis. In the wake of that, you may remember people talking about Merkozy.
Right.
Because you had Angela Merkel and Nicolas Sarkozy, and Sarkozy just kind of was in lockstep and did whatever Germany wanted because he didn't want to expose France's weakness. He just kind of followed along. So I think really for the last 8 years or so, Germany, it's been obvious, and a lot of people have been writing about how Germany is the one in the lead. I think what France is doing here, though, is they still consider themselves Europe's leading military power. And what they would like to do is they would like to get Germany to pay for France to continue to remain Europe's leading military power. And that's the subtext, I think, to a lot of what the French are doing when they call for more European military. What they really mean is they want more German cash for French military projects. And that, I think, is where then there is the potential and probably will be some friction. And I think Germany, with its hands on the cash here, has the advantage. And I think they will. This newly assertive Germany that we're seeing will press that advantage, and I think France will have to acquiesce. But it's not necessarily them graciously admitting Germany to the lead. It's more them trying to use this to their advantage and to say, okay, well, we're not the leader in Europe overall. We're not the leader of Europe's finances anymore, but maybe we can remain Europe's leading military power. I think that's what France wants here.
Fascinating stuff. This really want to encourage our listeners to go to the Trumpet Weekly. This is our free report that you can find on thetrumpet.com and read this article that we have posted in this week's edition. It's called France and the World Calls for Germany, with a lot of these quotes from different European leaders that are making statements that are really extraordinary in terms of how they're throwing their weight behind a German power, rising German power. Thanks for that, Richard. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We've been watching the relationship between the U.S. and the Philippines compromised in recent months, as Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has shown that he really wants to move away from the U.S. and toward China. Well, the Philippines isn't the only Asian ally America has that's moving in that direction. To learn about others, we're going to go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, we have devoted a bit of time to that shift happening there in the Philippines. We've also talked a little bit on a previous episode about the same thing happening with Malaysia, another longtime partner of the U.S., suddenly tilting instead toward China. These countries are essentially defecting to the Chinese side. And now this week, we have to ask, A2 Thailand? Thailand is one of two treaty allies that America has in Southeast Asia, but it looks like they too are now laying the groundwork to ditch America and to defect to the Chinese side. On Tuesday, news broke that Thailand is buying a sizable quantity of tanks from China. These are some of China's VT-4 tanks, and the Thai military is buying at least 28 of them with an option to expand that order later. And then the Thai defense officials also said that they've suddenly made China a consultant on Thailand's joint investments on heavy weaponry. And this news from Tuesday came just about 2 weeks after a big announcement saying that China and Thailand are planning to build a massive joint military production facility, basically just a big weapons factory that they would both use for armaments research and development. And really, this trend got started all the way back in 2015 when the air forces of China and Thailand held their first ever joint exercises, and that was huge news. And right around that same time, Thailand also selected China for a multi-billion dollar contract to build Thailand's first submarines. And then in the time since then, we've also seen the two sides take steps toward working together on things like military training, personnel exchanges, and anti-terrorism cooperation. So this tank deal from this Tuesday is really, it's not just a one-off kind of a deal. It's part of a major trend that's underway there in Thailand. And in the Trumpet Weekly this week, we've published some excerpts from a diplomat article. And basically, this article explains that this is happening because of Thailand's cooling relationship with America. One quote from it says, "China-Thai military cooperation has deepened of late amid a downturn in U.S.-Thai relations." And so that downturn happened starting back in 2014 after a military coup brought the current ruling junta to power in Thailand. The U.S. has been very concerned about human rights violations as a result of that coup and also just a collapse of democracy. And so the U.S. has been reluctant to work with this ruling junta because they, you know, they came to power as a result of ousting the democratically elected government. But then you've got China saying, "Hey, Thailand, I know the U.S. is criticizing your military coup. I know the U.S. is sermonizing to you about human rights violations and about very sensitive domestic issues there in Thailand. But here in China, we don't do any of that. We couldn't care less about democracy and human rights and things like that. So why don't you guys forget about the sermonizing United States and instead just cozy up to us?" And the leadership in Thailand, with all these new deals and efforts toward cooperation, we see that in Thailand, they're basically saying, "Okay, China, that sounds pretty good." So with these nations, the Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, and it's happening to a lesser degree in other nations as well, with these nations defecting to the Chinese side, it really is evident that America's position in Asia is quickly weakening. And it does look like a zero-sum kind of a game with a lot of these nations. It's happening in a way that is tipping power and influence directly into China's direction.
So China growing in power, Asia unifying, two trends, and America's influence in Asia waning, three trends that we've been tracking for quite some time. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks for that, Jeremiah. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. What would it be like if the government paid you to just exist? You could just sit on your couch all year round. Paychecks would magically arrive. Well, two cities in Scotland are actually trying to make this happen, or looking into it anyway. For this story, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, two actually very large cities in Scotland, Glasgow and Fife, they're currently in negotiations, the city councils are, to introduce a pilot program later this year to offer their citizens what's called a universal basic income. The idea would be that you'd basically abolish means-tested welfare, where you have to prove you're poor or prove you're unemployed to get money from the government, and just replace it with a blanket program where everyone in the city just gets a check each month for so much. And they haven't decided how much yet. But these Fife and Glasgow are definitely not the only cities who are really looking into this. They're the two cities in Scotland. But as we covered actually on this program last year, Ontario, Canada is looking to introduce a similar pilot program with one of their cities. They haven't chosen the city yet, but it's supposed to be done sometime this year. And Finland as well has chosen one of their cities. I forget the name of it right now, but to give every citizen, I think in their case, $1,320 every month, which would, it would account to about $15,000 a year. That if you if you're fine with $15,000 a year, you can just sit on your home, on your couch, and live off what would basically amount to a minimum wage income in America. If you want more money, then you can get a job, and it wouldn't count against you. You'd have your $15,000 plus the additional amount.
Right. And what are they trying to solve by doing this?
Basically, they're trying to solve poverty. If they can figure that, and in a lot of nations, they are trying to, or a lot of these pilot programs, they're trying to make their guaranteed income around the poverty level. No U.S. cities are doing it right now, but since our poverty level for a family of four is like $20,000, that would kind of be the idea, is that the government will just give everybody in America $20,000. That way, poverty is instantly solved, at least according to the, I mean, that there's going to be some inflation problems right, with just that much extra money. But by giving everyone $20,000, that is the idea, is that you'd solve poverty.
So, yeah, they're ignoring the biblical point of view that if you don't work, you don't eat. It says in 1 Timothy 5. And so you ignore that type of law that really is an inexorable law that you can't avoid, and you're going to end up with problems. But who consults the Bible? We appreciate that, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com. Go there to receive a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories that we talk about on this program, we put in this report, and you can have it for free. We'll finish the program with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
It's time now for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, and we'll start with Richard.
America invaded Poland this week. Of course, the invasion was invited. More than 2,700 U.S. military vehicles and pieces of equipment arrived in Poland. A few of them, I think somewhere in the region of 150, were main battle tanks. So America is increasing its pressure or presence in Eastern Europe because Eastern Europeans are so worried about Russia. But Russia is also not very happy about this deployment, and it is ratcheting up tensions. It'll be interesting to see what happens there with Donald Trump's inauguration now coming up.
All right, we'll go now to Brent.
A U.S. Navy destroyer fired three warning shots at armed Iranian patrol boats on Sunday as they sped towards the American warship at the entrance to the Persian Gulf. The group of four fast attack boats of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps had ignored multiple attempts by the crew of the USS Mahan to warn them away. This prompted the decision to fire the three warning shots. The incident is the first such one in 2017 between Iran and the United States. 2016 marked a 50% increase in provocative acts by the Iranian Navy against the United States in the Persian Gulf.
And over to Andrew.
On Tuesday, the Mexican Council in Chicago announced to a group of ambassadors that Mexican immigrants are flocking to Chicago this week before the inauguration of Donald Trump next week due to its status as a sanctuary city. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel has already pledged that he will not deport any illegal immigrants, regardless of the incoming Trump administration's policies on that issue.
And Richard.
France wants to take over Britain's spot as NATO's number two. The second in command in NATO has traditionally always gone to a Brit. But after Brexit and with Britain's military declining, France is making a bid for that spot, according to an article in The Times. It's something to be expected as Britain declines, but it'll be something that'll be interesting to watch for if Europe pushes to have a much greater role and much greater control over what goes on within NATO.
All right, we'll go back over to Brent.
On Wednesday, Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar of the Eastern Libyan government climbed aboard the Russian aircraft carrier Admiral Kuznetsov as it was conducting exercises in Libyan waters. Haftar represents the armed forces of the Eastern Tobruk-based government, which is in direct competition with the EU and US-backed Government of National Accord operating out of Tripoli in the west of the country. While aboard the aircraft carrier, the Russian aircraft carrier. Hifter held a video conference call with the Russian defense minister. And according to Stratford, the meeting was a, quote, symbolic show of support for the House of Representatives and a demonstration of Russia's diplomatic clout. The House of Representatives being the Eastern government in Libya. The meeting took place just 1 week after the deputy leader of the GNA, the rival government in the West, announced his resignation, saying the UN-backed administration had failed to tackle urgent problems arriving from years of conflict and political disarray.
And now to Jeremiah.
In the aftermath of the U.S. presidential election and the U.K.'s decision to leave the European Union, China and the EU need to work together now more than ever. That is the assessment of an article published in the EU Observer. The article says the EU and China have entered uncharted diplomatic waters. They need to work together now more than ever. So it looks like the conditions are in place that could see a rapid strengthening of EU-China ties, which is building toward that mart of nations that the trumpet has long been watching for.
All right, we'll go back to Richard.
The Balkans are continuing to simmer. Tensions rose in the Balkans after January 9th, when Republika Srpska held its largest ever celebration for its national holiday. That particular date for the national holiday is controversial. Their constitutional court has ruled commemorations on that day illegal. Srpska wants to be independent from the rest of Bosnia. That's kind of the background to these tensions. So it's interesting to see those continue to simmer. And it's a potential area that could become destabilized in the kind of cold conflict between Europe and Russia.
All right. One more time to Brent.
Recently elected Lebanese President Michael Aoun met with Saudi King Salman on Tuesday in a bid to recommence Saudi Arabia's $3 billion arms donation to the Lebanese armed forces. Saudi Arabia had frozen the transaction last year as it felt it was further losing power inside Lebanon. According to the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Aoun is reaching out to Riyadh in an effort to show that Lebanon hasn't fallen into Tehran's orbit. However, Aoun himself, though a Christian, is aligned with Hezbollah's political movement inside Lebanon. Although Iran does look to hold power in Lebanon through its proxy Hezbollah, the trumpet does expect that Iran's dominance over the Mediterranean state to end in favor of a switching alliance with Saudi Arabia.
And we'll finish with Andrew.
President Barack Obama delivered his farewell speech Tuesday night. Speaking in his hometown of Chicago, he summed up his term in office and highlighted the accomplishments he feels most proud of, including the death of Osama bin Laden, the passage of Obamacare, the Iran nuclear deal, and the legalization of homosexual marriage.
All right, I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. You can look us up online at thetrumpet.com and receive a free subscription to The Trumpet Weekly, our weekly news report. Tell us what you think of the program by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Nachtigall.
Great to be here with you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Sir Arthur Helps. Wise sayings often fall on barren ground, but a kind word is never thrown away. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.